Welcome to Speaking Out for the Blind. I'm Brian McCallum. Millions of people around the world are suffering from eye diseases affecting the retina. The retina contains light-sensitive cells that receive and organize the words on a street sign or the text of a famous novel. Now there's hope for restored vision to those with retinitis pigmentosa and other degenerative retinal diseases. Second Sight Medical Products has created a new retinal prosthesis to restore vision. It's called the Argus 2. Second Sight's Vice President of Business Development, Brian Meck, joins me to talk about the prosthesis's benefits for blind people. Welcome to Speaking Out for the Blind, Brian.
Thanks, Brian. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
So, Brian, tell me about this retinal prosthesis and how it has the potential for changing people's lives.
Well, let me take a step back and explain a little bit about how it works. For these patients, retinal degeneration leads to blindness because the photoreceptors, that's the rods and cones in their eyes, have died. And what these photoreceptors do is they take the incident light that's coming through your pupil and lens to the back of the retina, and they convert it into an electrochemical signal for the rest of the neurons in your retina to understand. And then that signal is transmitted along the optic nerve back to the visual cortex. What a retinal prosthesis does is it simply replaces the function of these photoreceptors and provides the electrical signal to those remaining neurons in the retina directly based on a video signal that is sent in from an external camera. So the patient is wearing a pair of sunglasses with a very small camera in the bridge of the nose. The camera is collecting the video of the scene around them. It's connected to a very small computer about the size of a deck of cards that we call a video processor that processes the video signal, maybe does things like contrast enhancement or edge detection or any other image processing that you can think of, sends that now processed video signal back up to the glasses, and then there's a little antenna on the side of the glasses that sends that video signal into the implant. And there's an implant in the eye that was surgically implanted. It consists of electronics and then an electrode array that's fixed onto the retina at the back of the eye. And this array of electrodes is, you can think of it like pixels on a scoreboard. You stimulate the appropriate pixels at the appropriate signal strength to produce sort of a black and white crude image on the retina. And then this image is sent back to the visual cortex. So that's how it works. And what it does is it takes people that are completely blind from these diseases, especially retinitis pigmentosa, and it brings them back up to low vision. So it's not 20/20 vision like a normally sighted person would have, but it's a sort of a crude approximation of low vision, which does allow these people to regain a lot of functional vision and do things using their eyes that they haven't been able to do oftentimes for decades.
And now I take it that the video processing unit must be the power source for the Argus 2, correct?
That is correct. There's a battery on that video processing unit that provides power both for that processor but also for the implant. And so when that video signal is sent in wirelessly to the implant on a different carrier frequency, we're also sending in power to the implant. So there's no battery on the implant side because we didn't want to have a battery that could eventually die and require the implant to be replaced.
Right. Now, let's talk about the background of the Argus 2. My listeners and I are specifically curious about the device's history. How did the idea for this retinal prosthesis originate?
Well, maybe some of your listeners are familiar with something called a cochlear implant. And a cochlear implant does essentially the exact same thing for people that are deaf. For people that are deaf because the cilia in their ears are no longer working, cochlear implants are also electronic devices that stimulate the cochlea to produce sound. And they've been around for, well, 3 decades now, and they've been commercially available for almost 2 decades. And they are very effective devices and restore hearing to a level that allows people that were otherwise completely deaf to carry on conversations on a telephone, which is pretty remarkable. And so in the I'd say in the early 90s, there were a few doctors at Duke University, doctors Gene DeWan, Mark Humayun, and Robert Greenberg, who were thinking, wondering aloud whether or not the same idea could be used to treat retinal degeneration. And shortly thereafter, the team moved to Johns Hopkins and conducted some acute experiments in the OR with volunteer patients, where they basically stuck a wire in the eye and passed some electrical current and asked them if they could see anything. And they did this on about 24 patients that were in the operating room for some other reason anyways. And every one of them, I think, was able to see something. So they were able to electrically induce spots of light in the visual cortex by stimulating at the retina. And that's kind of where the idea was born. And then the next question became, well, that's fine and dandy if you can do it for a half hour in the OR. That's not very useful. But, you know, can you do it for a long period of time? And in order to answer that question, Second Sight was born back in November of 1998. And it was headed up by Robert Greenberg, who's still the president and CEO, and Alfred Mann and Sam Williams were the principal investors in the early going. And Alfred Mann had already invested in several active implantable medical device companies, and including a cochlear implant company, which at the time was called Advanced Bionics. And now, so Second Sight started up, and what we did in the early going, because we wanted to answer the question, the first question you wanted to answer was, could you stimulate the retina for a long period of time and continue to give these people some vision without damaging the retina? And in order to answer that question, we took a cochlear implant that was already approved, and we modified the electrode array of that cochlear implant, and we got approval from the FDA to conduct a small clinical study in 6 patients at the University of Southern California. So by that time, doctors DeWan and Humayun had moved from Johns Hopkins to the Doheny Eye Institute at USC. And between 2002 and 2004, 6 volunteer subjects participated in the trial and received the implant. It was only 16 electrodes, so you're reducing your vision to 16 pixels of light. And again, the idea was sort of proof of concept. Could you stimulate for long periods of time? And the answer turned out to be very unequivocally, yes, you could. And in fact, there's still a couple of patients using the device today, daily. And what was more amazing, I think, was the fact that even with just 16 electrodes, some of those patients were doing some amazing things like, you know, navigating on their own outside, avoiding objects, shooting baskets. Just some things that you would never have thought were possible. And then we moved on and we started developing what we called the Argus 2. So that first generation device was the Argus 1. And we wanted to increase the number of pixels, which we did to 60. And we wanted to make the device much smaller and not cochlear implant based, because a cochlear implant requires a team of surgeons in about 8 hours to put in. So we wanted a much smaller implant that would go entirely in the orbit and require maybe a couple of hours to surgically implant. And so that's what we did with the Argus 2. And we began a clinical study of the Argus 2 in 2007 in both the U.S. and in Europe.
And how did those clinical trials go? What were the results?
Well, the results were quite positive, actually. So there were 30 participants in the trial across 10 sites between the U.S. and Europe. And every single patient received the benefit of electrically induced visual percepts. After that, there was significant variability, I would say, in the outcomes of the patients in terms of what they could do with the vision that was restored. And in most cases, there were significant improvements in what we call orientation and mobility skills. So that's the ability to follow lines, find doors and windows, avoid objects in your path. So that was really our goal for this. That's what we wanted to be able to do, is help these people ambulate in both familiar and unfamiliar environments. But beyond that, there were other improvements. More than a quarter of the patients regained a visual acuity that was actually measurable. So all of these patients were completely blind to begin with. And 8 out of the 30 actually got back up onto the visual acuity scale. And some of those best patients were able to begin reading words and sentences composed of fairly large letters about 3 or 4 centimeters in height.
Now, I read on Second Sight's website that the Argus 2 can restore partial sight to people who have retinitis pigmentosa, or RP for short. What's RP, and what are some of the symptoms associated with that disease?
Retinitis pigmentosa is actually a collection of inherited retinal degenerative diseases that all look very similar to a doctor that would be examining your eye. So from outward appearance, looking inside your eye, they look very much the same. But there's, I think, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 120 different known genetic mutations that lead to an RP-like disease. So typically for a patient that has RP, and it really does depend on the exact genetic mutation, they begin maybe in their early teens to notice a loss of night vision. Gradually, their peripheral vision begins to disappear, and they end up somewhere in their 40s, maybe with something that's well described as tunnel vision. So they'll have very good acuity, but only in a very small visual field of maybe 3 to 5 degrees. And then eventually that tunnel will close off too, and they'll go completely blind in many cases, but not all. And the different genetic mutations might mean that the disease progresses either further or faster or slower. It kind of really depends. So that's kind of what the symptoms are. And it's a good place for us to start because these patients essentially had no vision left. So they're not risking very much from a visual perspective when they participate in a clinical trial.
I also hear that the Argus 2 can restore partial sight for those who have other degenerative retinal diseases. What are those diseases?
Well, I think we have to be a little cautious here. I think in the U.S., when we have approval in the U.S., the label will probably read very strictly retinitis pigmentosa only. What we believe is that there's no reason why this therapy wouldn't help other people with rod cone dystrophies that are not classified as RP, but are essentially have the same root cause, which is loss of photoreceptors. And those would include, there's some other sort of smaller diseases like choroideremia, rod cone dystrophy, and a handful of others. Then, of course, there's something which affects a much larger population called age-related macular degeneration, and specifically, which is AMD for short, and specifically that comes in both what is called a wet and a dry form. We believe, but we don't know for sure yet, that for dry AMD patients that this might be helpful for them. And in fact, we're going to try to start a study looking at that before the end of this year. Probably in Europe, looking at a handful of patients to see if we can provide any benefit for them with a device like this.
There's an important question that our listeners would like to know. For the people that are candidates for these retinal implants, what are the risks?
Well, first of all, the patient undergoes surgery to have the device implanted. So you have all of the risks that accompany general surgery. So, for instance, the patients are under general anesthesia when they get the device, and there's risks with anesthesia. Some people have allergic reactions. Then, of course, there's the risks that accompany any sort of invasive surgery, the risk of infection, and other things like that. Beyond that, now you talk about what about the risks to the eye and to the vision. Well, in our case, for the clinical study, there was basically little or no residual vision in any of these patients when they entered the trial, so there wasn't much to lose there. However, some of them did experience some what we call adverse events, so safety-related adverse events that were a consequence of the device being there. Most of these were fairly mild and classified as non-severe, and then there were a handful of what are termed serious adverse events. Things like infection in the eye, hypotony, which means low eye pressure, And almost all of these were well managed by doctors, so there was nothing that was sort of chronic or long term that wasn't able to be treated. But there are definitely risks that have to be considered by any patient when considering this therapy.
All right. So you're working with some partners to develop this prosthesis. In fact, a more advanced model of it with the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. And I attended a lecture by them in March, and they're advancing this technology forward. In the coming years to come, say 3, 5, 7, or 10 years, what are some of the advancements in the technology of the Argus II that you expect?
So one thing I think that's important for prospective patients to understand, if and when the device is available in the United States, is that the external system, which is the glasses with the camera and that visual processing unit I talked about, they're outside the body and they can be upgraded pretty easily, you know, to take advantage of developments in those technologies. So in other words, new camera technology, new microprocessor technology, new video imaging processing technology, all of that is relatively easy to upgrade and update on the externals without ever touching the implant. And in fact, we did this a number of times during the clinical study because we were learning a lot about how to better stimulate these patients, electrically stimulate these patients to produce more useful vision. And now we're going through an upgrade where we're increasing the processing power. We've already changed the camera to be a more light-sensitive camera, things like that. And so we think that that's sort of the kinds of improvements you're looking at on a 3 to 5 year horizon. We're going to be continuing to upgrade those external components to provide better functional vision. The next sort of level of what we're working on is an improved implant. And generally, the name of the game here is more electrodes. So the next generation implant will have probably 240 electrodes, so about four times as many as we have now. And hopefully that means that the spatial acuity will be about four times better than what we have now. But that's not necessarily the case. We won't know for sure until we actually try it out. And it turns out, and that's kind of where Livermore and the rest of the Department of Energy project, it wasn't just Livermore. There was five national labs involved in this and a few universities. They were working on technology that would allow us to increase the channel count on the device. So that's really where they come in. The problem, it's not so much a problem, but it's the reality of doing medical device development, is that the time horizon for introduction of a new product is quite long. So the Argus II, we started working on the design and development of Argus II in 2000. We started the clinical trial of the Argus II in 2007, and we had approval of the Argus II in Europe in 2011, and potentially here in the United States in 2012 or 13, provided that the FDA actually approves the device. So that kind of gives you an idea of the timeline. It's 12 years or so from concept to approval. Hopefully we would shorten that on the next go around because we've done it once before. But even at that, you're looking at still a long timeline. So that's why I talk about the Argus III in sort of a 5 to 10 year and possibly closer to that 10 year number horizon for introduction into the marketplace. It takes a while.
Now, you're talking about the FDA of possible approval. Mm-hmm. I did read about that they may approve the device for sale in America later this year. I also read a story that there's going to be an FDA panel meeting coming up in Washington this September that's actually open for public comment. I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about that meeting.
Yeah, sure. So we submitted our application to the Food and Drug Administration last year, application for approval based on the results of the clinical study. And they've been reviewing that application since that time, and we've been having lots of discussions with them. And What happens is once they're comfortable with the application and they feel like they have a good understanding of it and they feel that it's a complete application and they're pretty happy with the application, then they convene a panel. They don't always convene a panel, but for typically for a first-in-class treatment like ours, so which this really is, these patients have had no treatment alternative ever to this date. So this is a first-in-class therapy for retinitis pigmentosa. And so it's not uncommon for the FDA to convene a panel of experts to do a review in these types of cases because they want independent corroboration that the data justifies that the probable benefit outweighs the risks associated with the therapy. And so that's what's going to happen on September 28th in Gaithersburg, Maryland, a panel of experts, primarily experts in the area of ophthalmology and retina and vitreoretinal surgery, will convene there. And basically, the entire day is spent doing questions and answers based on a presentation that we will make, a presentation that the FDA will make, and then our complete application, which will have been reviewed by the panel. And at the end of that very long day, and like you said, in the middle, there's an hour reserved for public comment, and I'll come back to that. But at the end of that very long day, the panel will vote in public in front of everybody, basically a yes or no to the ultimate question, does the probable benefit outweigh the risks associated with the therapy? And so you'll know at the end of the day what side of that the panel fell on. So if the panel votes, quote, yes, that the therapy should be approved, that doesn't quite constitute approval. It's still up to the FDA to approve it, and that can still take anywhere from sort of 2 to 6 months after the panel decision. Similarly, if the panel votes no, that doesn't necessarily mean that the FDA has to disapprove it, but it's quite likely that they will.
Okay, and so how can listeners, do they have to register for this event, or do they just show up, or?
Well, if they just want to watch it, they can just show up. If they want to make a comment during the public comment period, there are a couple of things they should know. One is that there's only an hour, and speakers will be restricted likely to 5 minutes. So that's a total of 12 public session comments that will be allowed. If there are more than 12 applicants for those sessions, then they will do a lottery, I think, to select those that will actually get to present. And there is a process. If you go to fda.gov and type in the keywords Argus 2 panel, where the 2 is in Roman numerals, so Argus II panel, I think the first link that shows up will give you a link to the FDA page on this advisory panel. And there's information there about who you should contact if you want to speak and make a public comment that day.
Some of our listeners are looking forward to attending that event. So if the Argus 2 does get the FDA's approval, mm-hmm. when do you expect the first supplies of the retinal prosthesis to be released into the American market?
I would think, so if from the date that the FDA says yes, we're probably looking at maybe just a few months to release it in the market. There might be a few things we need to address based on their approval. So just building in a little bit of time for that, we're probably looking at 3 to 6 months before it's commercially available. And I'm sure there will be significant buzz about that because this will be, you know, sort of the first ever treatment for people that are completely blind and that restores some vision, which is pretty amazing when you think about it.
Where will this surgery be available if these devices do get released?
My guess is we don't have that completely mapped out, but we have a good understanding. We'll probably start with the 6 U.S. sites that participated in the clinical study, and they're in New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Dallas, L.A., and San Francisco. And then we'll probably very quickly add another handful of locations because we don't have much in the way of the Midwest or anything right down the middle of the country. So in order to help patients out there, we'll probably, I wouldn't be surprised if there's another 4 to 6 U.S. sites within 8 to 12 months after approval.
So where can people find more information on the Argus 2?
Well, I think a good place to start is our website, which is www.2-site.com. That's literally the number 2 and then a hyphen site, SIGHT.com. And that's a good place to start in terms of information. There's some email addresses there that they can send emails to, and that lots of those emails come to me personally and to other people at the company. So we're happy to respond either by email or with a phone call. I talk to lots of prospective patients all the time. So that's a great place to start. In terms of the FDA panel meeting, I gave that earlier website, fda.gov, keywords, Argus 2 panel. So I think that's a great place to start.
Good resources.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to add before we're out of time?
Just a sort of a general comment on ophthalmology and the state of the research here. It's really an amazing dawn of an era here. This will be the first ever treatment, hopefully, for people that are blind. But there's some amazing work being done that will, I think, make these kinds of treatments or solutions for blindness routine maybe in 20 or 30 years, which is pretty amazing. Whether it's gene therapy or stem cell therapy or optogenetics or what have you, there's a lot of amazing research being done. We happen to be the first to get this far, which is great. And I hope that we're successful, because I think success breeds success. So if our story is a good one, I think it'll attract the interest of other researchers, of other investors and things like that, which is kind of what is needed, that sort of critical mass of interest and money and key people is really important to delivering therapies that are so expensive and time-consuming and take so many years to develop. And so,
okay, Brian, we're going to stop you there, but okay. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Brian. Thank you also.
That's all for this edition of Speaking Out for the Blind. Thanks for listening, and remember to speak out.